continue with the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. We'll be discussing the section of the avatars. So this is the only section in the fourth chapter which talks about avatars, or in fact in the whole Bhagavad Gita which talks about the avatars, and it doesn't explicitly use the word avatars while talking about it. It basically talks about the concept. So till now, in the fourth chapter, Krishna has said that I give this knowledge, and when the knowledge is lost, he is going to say that I have given you this knowledge again because the knowledge was lost. And he will talk about a general principle after this. So in 4.5 he said that I am omniscient. I don't forget anything. Time does not remove my memory. And that is, he takes the next verse. Why is that? Because I exist beyond the realm of time. I am ajaha. And then if you exist beyond the realm of time, then when and why do you come in the realm of time? That is a natural question that comes up. So Krishna will answer that in the next two verses, which are probably among the most famous verses in the Bhagavad Gita. Yada yada hi dharmasya,
yada yada hi dharmasya,
glanir bhavati bharata,
glanir bhavati bharata,
abhyutthanam dharmasya,
abhyutthanam dharmasya,
tadatmanam srujamyaham,
tadatmanam srujamyaham.
So yada yada, so Acharya explained that yada yada, two yada means whenever and wherever. So it is geographically and chronologically. That's why the two yadas are there. That at all places and all times, whenever there is dharmasya glanihi, there is decrease of religion, bhavati, it happens, O Bharata, then. And so naturally, dharma and adharma are like the two sides of our weighing balance. So when one side goes down, naturally other side comes up. So when one side becomes heavier, the other side will actually have to go up. So like that, whenever dharma becomes lesser, then adharma will actually become higher. So Krishna is telling that abhyutthanam adharmasya, when dharma goes down, adharma comes up, then I appear in this world. Tadatmanam sujamyaham. And Srila Prabhupada hints at this point of the second meaning of yada when he says that actually he says in this or in the next purport. Prabhupada in the next purport talks about how there are so many incarnations of the Lord, and here in one of the he sends his bona fide representative in the form of his son or servant or himself in some disguised form. So basically what Prabhupada is saying is that this is a universal principle, that whenever there is a decline of religion, God will appear. And then he says it is not that God appears only in one place, he appears everywhere. And he will teach according to time, place, circumstance. According to time, place, circumstance, he will teach. So now, Srijami at one level can mean create. So Srila Prabhupada explains that why Srijami cannot literally mean creation, because Krishna's forms are eternal. So Krishna Srijami cannot mean eternal. Krishna Srijami cannot mean creation because the forms are eternal. So in general, when Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita, if we look at the overall flow of the Bhagavad Gita, the meaning is very clear. There is no doubt. We will look later on in the Bhagavad Gita, Aham Sarvasya Prabhu, Krishna is saying. So Aham means I. Then Krishna says in 15.19 that there is no truth, there is one who understands me to be the highest truth and worships me, such a person knows all the Vedas. So if you look at the overall flow of the Vedas, things will be clear. But there are places where Krishna allows Mayavadis to fiddle around if they want. Because ultimately, Nityo Nityanam, Chetanas Chetanam, Eko Bahunam, Yo Vidhati Kaman. So the one is maintaining the many. So that maintenance of the many is not just in terms of physical maintenance. Yes, he is providing the rains and the grains by which all the individual souls can be maintained in material existence. But he is also providing souls material by which they can be maintained in their misconceptions. So if somebody wants to disbelieve in God, Krishna will provide them facility for that. So sometimes the atheists ask, you know, if God is providing rains, then why does God provide rains on the ocean? You know, if rains are meant to provide us water, then why are rains needed on the ocean? Yes, God provides rains on the ocean so that atheists can argue like this. That is a simple answer. Krishna See, whether rains come on the ocean or on the land, the point is that rains cannot come without exhaustive design. Now, first principle is the principle of exhaustive design. Beyond that, there is the principle that according to the karma, things will work out. Things will work out, and who knows, as far as science research is concerned, even ocean water, even the rains falling on the ocean water may also be purifying the ocean water in some ways. There are some scientists who say that also. We can't say that just because there is water, that means there is no need for fresh water. That water is salty. It might be needed. We don't know. But even if we find out that there is no function of rains falling on the ocean, see, there are two different issues over here. We are slightly diverting from something, but it's an important topic. In the universe, we will see some places where there is design and some places where there is chaos. We don't see design everywhere in the universe. In fact, in advanced physics, there is a whole theory called chaos theory. Chaos theory means, what they say is that the whole behavior of particles is unpredictable. You cannot have any equations or patterns to describe their behavior. But what you can do overall is, you can try to find out how this behavior actually can be understood in terms of statistical patterns. So they have this chaos theory. So it is true that if that certain parts of the universe may be behaving in ways that we can't comprehend. So whether they are completely chaotic or they are having order that we can't discern, who is supposed to say that? Its second possibility is also there. And even if certain parts of the universe are chaotic, still that doesn't prove anything. Because if say I come to a house and there are 5 rooms in the house and 3 rooms are extremely clean, spick and span, and 2 rooms are completely messy. So now messy rooms can happen by the because there is no caretaker, or messy rooms can happen because there is some other purpose in which the caretaker is neglecting them. So, there are multiple possibilities why rooms can be messy. But if there is even one room that is clean and well ordered, then that clean room requires a cleaner. So, even if out of 100 parts of the universe, 50 parts are well designed and 50 parts are chaotic, it's not like that. Much, much more is well designed. But even if 50 parts were well designed, then, see, a mess can happen because of the absence of a designer. Mess can happen because of some other person disrupting the design that somebody has made. Or mess can happen because of the negligence of the design. Just a mess doesn't disprove the existence of a design. But if there is design in any part of the universe, and if you can have a statistical probability to show that design cannot come by chance, then that is a strong evidence for a design. See, most of us know that story about how there was a theistic person who went to a doctor, and the doctor saw that this person believes in God. You believe in God? He said, of course. He says, there's so much misery in this world. How do you believe in God? This person didn't say anything. Then he went out. And after he went out, when he came back, after a few minutes, he said, there is no doctor in the city. He says, what do you mean? There is no doctor in the city. No, I'm a doctor. You are just treated. What do you mean? Just come. He took him out. And outside there was a person who was coughing, a beggar on the street, coughing bitterly. And he says, the very fact that he is sick proves that there is no doctor in the city. Are you crazy? He is sick because he is not coming to me. So this devotee said, exactly. People are suffering, there is disorder because people are not going to God. So just the presence of disease does not disprove the existence of a doctor. That is not the only explanation. There are alternative explanations also. Similarly, in the universal order also, just because there is some chaos somewhere, that doesn't prove that there is no God. All that it proves is that there some other factors might be involved why the order is not seen. The person is not, all of us have free will, and if we don't participate in Krishna's order, then there can be disorder as a result because of our own misdeeds or reactions to our misdeeds. So basically, this is the understanding, but of how evil is present in this world or how disorder is present in this world. But even any order that is present, that indicates that there has to be a designer. So, this is actually a very important principle of logic to understand this. So, what this means is, where are we going now? If we say this is called a logical syllogism, I'll not go into technicalities here, I'll keep things simple. So say if A leads to B, let me say, what is A over here? Disorder. And B is, or from A you can infer B. That if there is disorder, then you can infer the non-existence of God. So if there were disorder, it's true that we can say God is non-existent. But this does not mean, let's put it this way, make it simpler to understand. See, I'll explain what I'm saying so to make it clear. See, there are two issues over it. There is one effect and one cause. So we are trying to find out what is the correlation between the two. So the effect that we see is that, okay, I see some disorder in this world. So then, that from that disorder in the world, I can say that God does not exist. Only if that disorder does not have any other cause. If the disorder does not have some other cause, then I cannot conclude that there is no God, because the alternative explanations also have to be considered. So therefore, basically this particular form of logic, let's put it this way. So it is true that if there were no God, then we would have, if A is non-existence of God, then we will have B, that is disorder. But if I have B, does that prove A? No, it doesn't prove A. That is wrong. Why? Because B can have some other causes. Similarly, that means if there is disorder in the world, that does not necessarily prove that God doesn't exist. But on the other hand, if I see that there is, if say now that we'll have C and D over here, is this point clear to all of you? Simple logic, but it is an important point in logic. Second point is that let's consider C and D, two factors. So C is that there is design in the world, and D is there is a designer, that is God. So now, what are the possibilities? That if design is there, designer is required. Now, if there is design anywhere in the world, that design will require a designer. That design will require a designer. Even if everywhere else, if I go to a room in 100 rooms and 99 rooms are dirty, one room is pick and span clean. Now, I know by chance rooms can become dirty. By chance rooms don't become clean. Isn't it? So even if one room is clean, I'll have to seriously consider the idea that there must be a cleaner. Similarly, even if one part of the universe were designed and all others were chaotic, still we would have to seriously consider the idea that there has to be God. So going to the same point now, if C, there is evidence of design, then we have D. Existence of God. Okay, let's put it this way. If
if there's existence of God, then there will be evidence of design, because God will design the world properly. Now if I see D, then there has to be C, because there is no alternative explanation for the design. So because even one case of design, it is exceptional. So if I say that all people are if all only men become pregnant and women don't become pregnant. Only women become pregnant, men don't become pregnant. So if I say that, I make a statement. Now for this statement, even if there's one exception, if I find one man who is becoming pregnant, then I can disprove the idea. It's, if I want to disprove the theory that all birds are black, I don't need to prove that all birds are white. Even one bird being white is enough. If I want to prove that, similarly, that this whole universe has not been designed, then if I find even one evidence of design, that is good enough. So then that is good enough to disprove the idea that the universe has not been designed. So similarly, the point which we are discussing over here is, we are trying to understand these words, two words, Sambhavami and Srujami, that come in these 4.6 and 4.7. So these words seem to have the idea of creation over here. So literally, if you look at a Sanskrit, they mean creation. So now, if we look at the dictionary, Haridayan Maharaj has written an elaborate article on this. If I go into that, I'll require a 3-hour class for that. He has taken the standard dictionary and he has taken, that's how the word Srujami has 8 meanings. And he analyzes all the 8 meanings. And he says, if you take this meaning, does it fit in the context of the Bhagavad Gita? Then second meaning, does it fit in the context of the Bhagavad Gita? Third meaning, does it fit in the context of the Bhagavad Gita? And then he shows that actually the only meaning, that the word meaning creation doesn't fit in the context at all. Because if you look at the overall flow of the Bhagavad Gita, it's very clearly said that Krishna has a transcendental form. So therefore, the word creation cannot fit in. So the only word that can fit in over here is manifestation. It's not creation. So Krishna says, I manifest my form. So I manifest my form to mortal vision. That's what is being talked about over here. So let's move forward with this. Abhidatmanam srujamyaham. And then Srila Prabhupada explains in the purport further about how ultimately the principles of religion essentially begin with varnashram. So without that, there may also be some religious principles, but there is no structure for spiritual growth. See, the speciality of Varanashram is that Varanashram offers a social structure that will help people to grow. It offers a social structure in the sense that, okay, I want to become serious about God, but how will I become serious about God? For becoming serious about God, do I just have to renounce the world? Then the number of people who can renounce the world is few. So, actually, Varanashram, it has been so much maligned as a caste system. The Hinduism had such a degraded caste system. But nowhere in any other religious system of the world has anything similar been evolved where a whole social structure has been arranged for systematic spiritual advancement. It's a very well-designed system. It can be misused, it has been misused, that is undeniable. And that is certainly regrettable. But that doesn't mean the original system was wrong. Actually, it's such a brilliant understand system by which there are two ways of progression. One is that a person can divide his life into different time spans. And then, according to different time spans, the person can focus initially entirely on spiritually, then he can enter into householder life, then he can go to vanaprastha and sannyas. We have time-wise division. So, everybody can get the opportunity to both practice spiritual life in a serious way, and also they can also engage in material life to the extent that they want. And secondly, everybody can take care of their material need in a materially natural way, that is according to their psychophysical nature. So in this way, it is the way, that's why Prabhupada, whenever he talks about dharma, he frequently talks about varanashram. The principle of varanashram is that, otherwise, if we see most people when they want to practice spiritual life, they just have to sort of go against society and then try to practice it. Varnashram provides a social structure for spiritual advancement. So of course people can never understand this unless they understand the principle of spiritual advancement. So if you try to defend the caste system as it is now, we don't have to do that. Prabhupada also didn't do that. Prabhupada said that it is a perverted caste system. But even if you want to make people understand the logic of Varnashram, the important thing is, first of all, you have to understand, make them understand the principle of spiritual advancement. So unless people understand that we are not the body or the soul, the whole principle of Varnashram will be very difficult to understand. But once we understand this, then we understand that that actually that this is the best system for spiritual life. What does the ashram do? Ashram provides a time-wise progression in one's spiritual commitment. And what does the Varana do? Provides for one's material needs in the least uncomplicated and the most harmonious way. According to one's psychophysical nature. So why psychophysical nature? Because different people have different mentalities, different abilities, different likes. So when they are engaged accordingly, then they can make smooth spiritual advancement. So in this way, Varana and Ashram, they are a system by which people can very systematically practice spiritual life. That's why the Prabhupada then talks about dharma. At this level, what is the dharma that Krishna is talking about? Krishna told earlier about how there will be Varana Sankara. If there is, if people don't follow their duties. So now he's going to move forward and say that actually one needs to practice Varanashram. So Krishna has come at this level, he's saying, to establish Varanashram Dharma. If not Varanashram Dharma, then some basic principles by which one can make spiritual advancement. So Prabhupada writes in one Bhagavatam purport about Buddha in the second canto, when the incarnation is talked about in the seventh chapter, he says that Buddha came to teach common sense religious principles. It's an interesting use. Common sense religious principles. So what is that? Ahimsa. It's common sense religious principles. So Varnashram is the best, but if Varnashram is not there, then at least some basic religious principles are taught about. And by that people make spiritual advancement. So now, after talking about this, Krishna will tell, in this verse he said, I come wherever and whenever there is glani of dharma. In the next verse he will say, what does he do when he comes? Paritranaya sadhunam,
Paritranaya sadhunam,
Vinashaya cha duskritam,
Vinashaya cha duskritam,
Dharma samsthapanarthaya,
Dharma samsthapanarthaya,
Sambhavami yuge yuge,
Sambhavami yuge yuge.
So Krishna describes three purposes. Paritranaya sadhunam, I protect the devotees. Vinashaya cha duskritam, destroy the demons, the demoniac people. And Dharma samsthapanarthaya. Now, actually speaking, if we see, these three are the duties of Kshatriyas. All these three, to protect the pious, we know that actually protecting the Brahmanas is one of the duties of a Kshatriya. Then protect the sadhus. To destroy the adharma, Kshatatrayati Kshatriya. That is the duty of Kshatriya. And overall, to establish religious principles. So, what Krishna is telling by this is, see, I empower the Kshatriyas with knowledge so that they can do these duties. But if somehow they are not able to do this duty, then I personally come and do this duty. So that means, when Krishna says, I empower the Kshatriya with knowledge, that means at that time Krishna is playing the role of a Brahmana. He is giving spiritual knowledge to the Kshatriyas. So Krishna plays the role of a Brahmana. But if the Kshatriyas are not able to do their duty, then Krishna himself takes the role of a Kshatriya. And Krishna does the duty. So in this way Krishna is telling that he does whatever is required for the establishment of dharma. He gives knowledge, and he implements the knowledge also. He implements the knowledge in terms of establishing a social system that is based on that knowledge. And he says, Sambhavami Yuga Yuga. I do this again and again, yuga after yuga. So, now here Krishna is talking about dharma samsthapana at the basic level. But we know in the 18th chapter, Krishna says, Sarvadharmaan Pratyaja Maam Ekam Sharanam. So, in one sense, Vedic culture is like a gradual progression. We normally use the word staircase. Or a slow progression, bhavanam janmanam. And that is also good.
because that is the pace at which most people can advance. Now Krishna says that I am coming to establish this. But at the end, for Arjuna's sake, Krishna will tell, you don't have to practice the gradual advancement, you practice the rapid advancement, that is Bhakti Yoga. So, is Krishna in the 18th chapter rejecting this teaching? No. There is the gradual process of Dharma and there is the rapid process of Dharma. So, in one sense, the Vedic culture offers people freedom. That there is Pravritti Marg, there is Nirvritti Marg. So, people can choose whichever Marg they want. So, Krishna is at this level talking about a Pravritti Marg. So, I come to establish order in society by which people can make spiritual advancement. Now, sometimes people ask that in Kali Yuga there is so much disorder. Why has Krishna not come? So, one way we can say that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come. So he has come and given the Yuga Dharma. That is true. Another point is Kali Yuga is such a deadly age. In the scriptures, often Channa Kalau Yad Abhavas Trigoth Sattvam. In Prahlad Maharaj's prayers, he quotes the standard Vedic saying that, that the Supreme Lord is Triyugi. Triyugi means he appears only in three Yugas. Satyuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga. He doesn't appear in the fourth Yuga, Kali Yuga. Why he doesn't appear in Kali Yuga? It's like, you know, there are some parts of Mumbai which are run by the underworld. And if somebody goes over there and gets robbed and gets beaten up, then he goes to the police and complains. I got robbed and beaten up over there. So then the police will ask, why did you go there? Even we don't go there. So, the idea is there are some places which are so filled with illegitimate activities that even the law enforcement agencies abandon those places. So there are large parts of Pakistan which are like that, you know, which are run by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and all those. So Pakistan, especially the Waziristan and all that part is there. But Pakistan government has no control over that. So anyway, the point is that some place where there are such illegal activities, the government says, you know, we don't care about it. So the idea of Tri Yugi is Kali Yuga is filled with such godlessness that God also forsakes this age. He says, I don't come in this age only. So that's the understanding of Tri Yugi. But this sees God only as a lawmaker. This is a valid analysis in one way, because the scriptures do say that he is Tri Yugi. But this doesn't consider the heart of God. From the legal point of view, okay, if you don't want to believe in me, don't believe me. Sometimes people ask, oh, why do we have this four yuga system? Why not have Satyuga all the time? Isn't it? Why have Kali Yuga at all? See, the purpose of this cycle is to facilitate the desires of the conditioned souls. If somebody has desires for gross, wholesale sense gratification, there is not much facility for that in Satyuga. You know, there may be, how many people can be there like Hiranyakashipu who can totally disrupt the universal order? But those who can get that much power to do that are few. But people, souls who want to do that, there are many like that. So for these souls, there is this age of Kali Yuga where there is, if you want to live with complete godlessness, total uninhibited sense gratification, and try it out. Krishna says, try it out. This is what you think will make you happy? Then try it out, and when your imagination is frustrated by the reality of the world, and you see that if things don't make you happy, then I'll be waiting. I'll come back to you. I'll guide you back to me. So basically, Kali Yuga is a facility for those souls, you know, who could not pass through the filter of time and mercy in the previous ages, and are like the refused remnants of the previous ages who pass on into this age. So, there is no glory in being born in Kali Yuga, in that sense, for any of us, for that matter. But this understanding that that Kali Yuga is a time which is given for those who are totally godless, that is correct. But at the same time, God never forsakes his children. And that's why Krishna comes, but in a hidden form. That's why Prahlad Maharaj prays in the 7th canto, 9th chapter. This is Channa Kalau Yad Abhavas Triyugotha Sattvam. Channa Kalau. You come in Kali Yuga as Channa Avatar. Channa is hidden incarnation. So, Prabhupada also quotes in this purport that the Lord sometimes comes in a disguised form. So, at one level, we can say Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come in Kali Yuga. Another point is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come and given the Yuga Dharma. That is, chanting of the holy names. So, now it is up to us. We practice the Yuga Dharma and we share the Yuga Dharma. So,
Srila Prabhupada had the mood that yes, Lord Chaitanya had made his prediction that the holy name will spread all over the world. And in every town and village, the holy name will be chanted. But he said, okay, a devotee doesn't have a passive attitude. And okay, Krishna has made the prediction, that will happen now. I just wait and watch. That was not Arjuna's attitude also. Arjuna fought to implement Krishna's will. So Prabhupada had a similar attitude. Prabhupada says that the Lord, fulfilling the Lord's prediction is my responsibility. That's how a devotee feels. The Lord has made a prediction, making it true is my responsibility. So to the extent I take up that responsibility, to that extent I will become dear to the Lord and I will make spiritual advancement. So it is up to us. And Srila Prabhupada asked, you know, how much will Krishna consciousness spread? Prabhupada said it will depend on the devotees. The more sincere, the more religion they are, the more it will spread. And devotees become lazy and devotees become quarrelsome and they don't follow the right of the principles, and Krishna consciousness movement can collapse. Then we may say, how will Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prophecy be fulfilled? So Prabhupada had so much confidence that people will read my books, and somebody who reads my book will start another movement, and that movement will fulfill Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prophecy. So if you look at the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, it's always been people who are relatively at the fringes. They have brought about a revival. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was not born in the Gaudiya Vaishnava family. He actually had no authority within Gaudiya Vaishnavism. He was not a caste Goswami. He was at the fringes. By his own spiritual search, he discovered Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And he realized it. Then he preached it and he brought respectability to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So he got practically no help from the existing power structures of Gaudiya Vaishnavism that were there. Similarly, Srila Prabhupada, he was at the fringes of Gaudiya matter. And in one sense, the people at that time may have thought that the Gaudiya Math is the institute that will fulfill the prophecy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And they are valid in thinking about it. It's not wrong, because Lord's mission is not attached to one particular designation. Lord's mission is not attached to one particular designation. Lord's mission is his mission. And it may take on different names and different forms. So Srila Prabhupada was at the sidelines, and from the sidelines Srila Prabhupada brought about a spiritual rejuvenation. Similarly, if you see Radha Gopinath temple, at one sense, you know, it was not even existing when Prabhupada came. You know, it was a whole project started after Prabhupada came. And now it is by Krishna's mercy, by the Radhanath Maharaj's visionary and dedicated hard work. Now yesterday we had such a beautiful festival where more than thousands and thousands of devotees come there sharing how there's been a miraculous transformation. So in general, even within our movement, now we shouldn't, of course we may not say we have the capacity to make big changes, but we shouldn't point out what is wrong. We should see what I can do right. Srinidhara Maharaj told a very beautiful statement. He said, somebody asked me, he said, you know, if ISKCON is the movement of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, why are there so many problems in the movement? Srinidhara Maharaj said, I told him that, you know, this is not the question we should be asking. We should be asking the question that, when Kali Yuga is the age of such degradation, where all the four regulated principles have been broken brazenly, how is a movement like ISKCON existing at all? So its existence itself is a miracle. And anyone who takes the initiative, that person can bring about a positive transformation. That's why the point here is that it is Krishna's mission and Krishna will carry it on. And he will find out some responsible soul who will take it up. So if we take up the responsibility, we will get the credit, we will make spiritual advancement, and we will go back to God. If we don't, then we will be left on the sidelines of history, and others will take it up. So devotees feel that fulfilling Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prophecy is my responsibility. It's not that I'll just be a witness of that, or not that I'll be a critic of that. No, I'll be an instrument for that. I'll try to fulfill that as much as I can. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come as the Channa Avatar, and he has given the holy name, by which people can free themselves from their demoniac propensities. As we know in the Jagaya Madhai pastime, Nityanthru told that if you start doing Vinashaj Duskrita, then what will happen? That will destroy everyone in Kali Yuga. Therefore, please destroy the demoniac propensities. That's what the mission is of the holy name. And actually speaking, if we look at our own lives, you know, we may have had so many desires earlier. But all those desires, which were to some extent demoniac, now Vinasha, so many desires have been destroyed. So when we do Harinam Sankirtan, actually Harinam Sankirtan is a way of massacring desires. It's like there's a machine gun, shoot. So the chanting of the holy names performance of the Harinam Sankirtan. It is a method for massacring our material desires. That is how Vishyana Vinyasaya Dushkritam works out in Kali Yuga. Now, generally speaking, most people who use Bhagavad Gita for their own material or secular purposes, they think of Dharmasya Glani in terms of material disorder. Oh, the law and order problem is there, and there is so much illegality and this and that. And that's why they talk only about these two verses. But actually speaking, from Krishna's perspective, and if you look at the flow of the Bhagavad Gita, the real purpose of Krishna's descent is described in the next verse. Krishna doesn't just come to establish order in this world. Because even with the best order in this world, there is going to be death. There is going to be misery in this world. So Krishna's ultimate purpose in coming in this world is not just to establish dharma in this world, to make it orderly, but to establish dharma so that we can come out of this world. And that purpose, which is not talked about by many of the people who quote Bhagavad Gita, that is described in the next verse. And you will see that Prabhupada quotes 4.9 much more than 4.7 and 8. Janma karma chame divyam.
Janma karma chame divyam.
Evam yo vetti tattvatah.
Evam yo vetti tattvatah.
Tyaktva deham punarjanma.
Tyaktva deham punarjanma.
Naiti mameti so Arjuna.
Naiti mameti so Arjuna.
So, Krishna is sitting over here. Janma karma chame divyam. My birth and my activities, both are divine, both are transcendental. And one who understands them how? Tattvataha. In truth. What will happen to such a person? Tattva deham. He will give up his body. He will also have to die. But after dying, punarjanma naiti. He will not have to take birth again. He will come out of the cycle of birth and death and he will come back to me. Mameti so Arjuna. So this verse actually describes the internal purpose of Krishna appears. It's like we have external and internal purpose of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's appearances. It's both the internal and principal purpose. He comes to take us out of this world. Now, in 4.7, Krishna said, Ajo, that I am unborn. But here he is saying that actually my janma is there and my karma is there. But one who understands it properly, in truth. So many people know about Krishna, but their knowledge about Krishna is just like the knowledge of some entertainment character. You know, I know this particular character, that particular character. They also know Krishna stories. That sort of knowledge will not help us much. Tattvataha. If tattvata knowledge is there, then we understand Krishna is God. He is not just an ordinary person. We understand Krishna is God. Then, you remember I said, without Krishna tattva, Krishna lila is amusing. With Krishna tattva, Krishna lila is
amazing.
How can a supreme God, Lord, become like a small child and play like this? It's amazing. So, that knowledge attracts our heart to Krishna. And when our heart becomes attracted to Krishna, then we can return back to him. So now, why is Krishna talking about these two specific things, janma and karma? Because the scriptures describe, the Upanishads describe that the absolute truth has no birth and no activities. So, therefore, if you have to understand the birth and activity, you have to understand that them to be divya, to be transcendental. And when we understand that, then tekva deham punarjanma naiti. Such a person will return back to me, because whatever Krishna will talk about the principle in the 8th chapter, whatever you think of at time of that, you will come to me. You will attain that. And if you are thinking of me, you will come back to me. And if you actually truly understand my birth and activities, you will fall in love with me. You will actually think about me. And then you will come back to me by that. So Srila Prabhupada will talk in this purport about how in the scripture, he quotes that how the Lord performs many pastimes. So Srila Prabhupada's purport is basically focusing on the principle of pastimes. So he quotes from the Purushabodhini Upanishad over here and he says, Eka Devo Nitya Leela Anurakto. Leela Anurakto. Leela is pastimes. So Janma Karma Chame Devyam, Prabhupada is correlating that Leela. Anurakto is engaged in that systematically. And what happens to that is, when he performs these pastimes, Bhakta Vyapi Hridi Antaratma. He enters into the hearts of the devotee by performing these pastimes. And this knowledge hearing is tattvataha. There is Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur Swami's example of licking a honey bottle from outside. That will not help. That will not help us to develop love for Krishna. So, then Krishna will describe how this process is time tested. Many people have followed this process and they have actually come back to me.
Vitaragabhaya krodha. Vitaragabhaya krodha. मन्मया मामुपाश्रितः
बहवो ज्ञान तपसः
भूतामद्भावमागतः.
सो दिस वर्स हैज मेनी सिग्निफिकेंट पॉइंट्स इन इट. द फर्स्ट इज I may have discussed this in the Ishopanishad course. Do you remember I discussed this? Vita Raga Bhaya Krodham. Raga Bhaya. So now, if somebody has to understand Krishna Tattvataha, what are the obstacles? These are three obstacles. First is Raga. What is Raga? This world is such a nice place. Why bother about Krishna? Attachment. Bhai. Relationships again. I was so frustrated with relationships in this world. I just don't want it at all. No, I don't want that at all. And Krodha. There are so many theories. Who knows which is true? Just forget the whole thing. So, these three mindsets are obstacles for us to understand Krishna. So, the first, Raga, is the Karmis, the materialists. The Bhaya is the Jnanis. Oh, I don't want any other relationships. I don't want any this and this. And if I have another form, then that form will also grow, will get diseased, I'll have so many suffering. I don't want that. And Krodha is skeptics. So the skeptics, they feel that how can you actually know anything? So there was a famous skeptic in the Western intellectual tradition. His name was Descartes. And he had the irony of Descartes. His philosophy was, doubt is everything. Unless you doubt, you can never know the truth. So we have discussed about Karmis and Jnanis elaborately. So we'll discuss briefly about skeptics now. And Karmis and Jnanis will come again also. In one sense, if you look at these three, how it is, this world is happy, why bother about that world? That world doesn't look happy, I don't want to go there. And third is, who knows what is there in that world, whether that world exists or not also, just don't bother about it. There are three basic mentalities, because of which we can't go from this world to that world, we can't redirect our love from matter to Krishna. So now skeptics, what is the nature of these skeptics? These skeptics, they have the idea that just because I can't know something, so it can't be known. And that is the error of their mentality. So, there was this theory, doubt is everything. You must doubt everything. Unless you doubt, you can never know the truth. This was the philosophy of René Descartes. And it has become quite popular now. You must doubt. So now it's true, you must doubt. But then if doubt is everything, then what happened was, this statement has a serious problem. Is this statement subject to doubt? So if doubt is everything, is this statement subject to doubt? So if no, then doubt is not everything. Isn't it? Statement is false. See this logical fun over here now. This is an end over here, but let's end it temporarily over here and move forward. And if yes, hmm. then the statement is false. Isn't it? If the statement is subject to doubt, then the statement can be false. The statement is not necessarily true. Isn't it? This is one level of analyzing this. So either way, what happens is you come to a dead end. You find that logic doesn't work. Sometimes you have seen in a computer, sometimes the computer gets hanged. So how computers get hanged? Basically, they go into endless do loop. Endless do loop. And then you just can't get it out. Then what you have to do? Externally press a power button. Then only they get off and then turn it on. So like that, if one, now basically skepticism is logic. By logic, I try to doubt everything. So if I try to go by Anuman, then I come with this idea and I find another idea to refute that idea. Then I come with third idea to refute the second idea. Then I come with the fourth idea to refute the third idea. And this just goes on endlessly. And then you get caught up in an endless loop. So if I just go by logic, I will never come to any conclusion. And that's why the only way to be saved from this maze of logic, this trap of logic, is you have to external shutdown. That means, what is that shutdown? Stop speculation, hear revelation. That is the only way one can actually be saved. Otherwise, speculation will just keep, then we will have an endless indecision. Only solution is stop speculation, hear revelation. How is speculation connected to Krodha? Because by speculation, if one carries the speculation to its ultimate extreme, then one comes to the conclusion that actually nothing can be known. And then one gets frustrated. Just let me not get into the whole thing at all. And therefore one just stays caught up in material life. So Ravindra Swarupu writes that before he was introduced to Krishna consciousness, he started studying philosophy. He went to a philosophy course and he said that once I started studying philosophy, then I became a professional skeptic. Just present me any philosophy, it became my sport to point out holes in the philosophy and destroy the philosophy. And then he puts his own basis. I became a high priest on the altar of skepticism. So I was worshipping skepticism and we said, we are very proud. We can just deconstruct any philosophy and destroy any philosophy. Then one day, but I found my heart was completely empty. Although I could intellectually be very proud and refute anyone and everyone, I was feeling empty. And then one day it struck me that actually I was not being sufficiently skeptical. He said, I was being skeptical of all philosophies, but I was not being skeptical about skepticism. I was not being skeptical of skepticism. Why? Because skepticism can only tell me what is wrong. Skepticism in and of itself can never tell me what is right. Isn't it? So, the problem with skepticism is that skepticism has no truth revealing potency. It can, skepticism can only show that which is false. It can never show that which is true. So he said that. Yeah. So that means he said, I became skeptical about skepticism. That means this, the skepticism doesn't have the power to reveal the truth. Therefore, let me be skeptical. I hope all of you know the meaning of the word skeptical. Skeptical means when somebody speaks something, I don't believe it. This isn't me. I don't believe it. It's not true. It's not logical. So skeptic means a person who is always doubting, critiquing, and basically refusing to believe. So he said, so then once there was a meeting of this philosophers, he told us, I think we are not being skeptical enough. We should be skeptical about skepticism. So there was one lady philosopher. She had been a Christian nun earlier, then she had given up her nunnery and had become an atheistic philosopher now. So I think you must be feeling like you're walking on a tightrope with nothing below. So he said, no, if I'm a skeptic, I don't even know whether the tightrope is there. So then he said, that little crack, my skepticism about skepticism was enough. What happened was, that crack in my skepticism was enough for Krishna to enter. And Krishna entered into it, and as he entered, he just took over my life. And as I started practicing Krishna consciousness, he said after a few years of practice of Krishna consciousness, I suddenly discovered that I believed in God, that I believed in Krishna as God. And he said it was not that I could make a logical argument for the existence of God. He said that actually it was something far more different than that. It seemed as if this faith existed in my heart independent of me. That means it was not that by the strength of logic, because this logical argument is there, therefore I believe in God. He said, I tried to use my skepticism to attack my faith. And my faith just threw off my skepticism. So I was very disturbed by this. What happened? So I thought I was a skeptic. Now I have actually got faith. It's not that I can logically prove that God exists, but I believe in God. I believe that Krishna is God. So he said, then I contacted my God brothers and they told me that this is Krishna's mercy. So basically when he's talking about this stage, what is he talking about? There is, you know, before bhajana kriya, before anartha nivritti, what is our faith? It is? Our faith is called shraddha. So at this stage, our faith often is tender and it depends on logic. But after anartha nivritti, the faith is nishtha. It doesn't depend on logic. So here it depends on logic, etc. So many other factors. You know, how devotees behave with us, you know, what happens where, if we hear some news somewhere, something went wrong in ISKCON, and then our faith gets disturbed. It's tender faith. So the acharyas give the example that this faith is like a banana tree. Banana tree, you know what happens? The elephant comes up and shakes it up and disrupts it completely. But based on experience and realization, when we have nishtha, that is based on experience and realization, and nothing can shake it. It is beyond logic. That doesn't mean a devotee is illogical, but a devotee doesn't depend on logic. And this is like a banyan tree. It is unshakable. Somebody who comes to shake it, that person himself gets shaken up. So over a period of time, by practicing Krishna conscious principles, our faith will go from Shraddha to Nishtha. So therefore, we may all also have our doubts. It's natural to have doubts. But what happens is that if I just stick to my doubts, if I am sick and I see a doctor, I go to, I doubt the doctor. It is I who will be the loser. It is I who will stay sick. Okay, I take a treatment, I find out if it works. If it works, wonderful, then I move forward. That's how this krodha may be sensible for a skeptic, but it just doesn't work. It doesn't work because it is based on a false premise. Any questions about this? So now, let's move forward. So Krishna is going to talk about one more thing over here. He uses the word bahavo. Many people in the past have become purified. Puta and madbhava magataha. They have attained my nature. Bhava. Now Prabhupada explains this word bhava means. He talks about this whole verse. Prabhupada is talking in terms of the nine stages of bhakti. This first time Prabhupada in the Bhagavad Gita as it is quotes adav shraddha sadhu sangha bhajana kriya. And he explains that this bhava means that by the practice of devotional service, when one manmaya maupashita, when one thinks of me and surrenders unto me, then the person will attain bhava. The person will attain bhava bhakti for me. Now there is this interesting compound word over here, jnana tapasa. So this word doesn't come again in the Bhagavad Gita, let's see what it means. Again, different acharyas have given different meanings for this. Bahavo gyan tapasa, and after that is followed by puta. Puta means purified. So putana means one who is not purified, one who is impure. Gyan tapasa puta. So gyan tapasa means you could have, what it means is purified by the austerity of knowledge. So knowledge about Krishna is to some extent austerity, because we think I am the greatest, and we hear that Krishna is the greatest. Krishna is the greatest. So one time one boy was asking, you know, if you hear about how Krishna is an enjoyer, you see how Krishna is dancing with 16,000 gopis, you see how much Krishna is enjoying. He says, won't we get an inferiority complex by that? If we hear about how Krishna is great, won't we get an inferiority complex? Actually speaking, our problem is not an inferiority complex, our problem is superiority complex. All of us have got a superiority complex. We think I am great. The whole, now, in the material sense, when people talk about inferiority complex, they feel like, oh, everyone else is good, I am bad. I can't sing, I can't speak, I can't do this, I can't do that. And that inferiority complex creates a sense of helplessness and weakness. And it basically makes a person impotent. But when we understand Krishna's glory, we understand that I am the servant. And we can say that it creates a sense of inferiority. But actually it frees us. It frees us because we understand that Krishna is not my competitor. See, when will I get an inferiority complex with another person? When I see that person as a competitor. But when I see Krishna as my Lord, as my lover, then the more I hear the glories of Krishna, the more my love for Him increases, the more my desire to serve Him increases, and the more my happiness increases. That's why if one has an envious attitude towards Krishna, then one cannot hear Krishna's glories. So that's why we are purified by the austerity of knowledge. So when we hear about Krishna, that jnana, that cultivating the jnana of Krishna is itself tapasya. And that tapasya will purify us. So now the word tapasya comes from the word tapa. Tapa means to burn, heat. So what happens is, the knowledge of Krishna itself purifies us. So the other meaning is, knowledge is the fire that purifies. So that means jnana is the tapa that brings out puta. So that is also another way of understanding this. Jnana tapasa puta. So if you just continue hearing about Krishna, that knowledge will act like a fire that will burn up the anarthas in our heart. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is the 8th canto. The verse about how devotional service is like fire. This is when there is a impure gold put in the fire, the impurities burn away and only the pure gold remains. So like that we become purified by the fire of knowledge. So this verse is entitled as Jnana Karma Sanyasa Yoga. It's called Divine Knowledge. So Krishna is talking about Jnana Tapasa. And this is Bahavo. Many people have become purified and they have returned back to me. So now, when it is Mad Bhavam Agataha. Now this is the second time Krishna has referred to some past people who have become purified. When was the first time?
Janakamana. 3.20.
Karamanaiva hi samsiddhim. Astita Janakadayaha. Now these two references, 3.20 and 4.10, Krishna will refer to them once again in 4.15. And he will tell that Evam Yatva Kritam Karma Purvai Rapun Mokshuni. That there are many other people who have acted like this in the past, and Arjuna, you should also act like this. So now we discuss three verses. These are very important verses, so that's why we went a little slowly. So first verse said that wherever and whenever the decline of dharma, I appear. Next verse said that I appear to re-establish dharma. And this verse says that ultimate purpose of re-establishing dharma is to bring people back to me. So now, after this, Krishna's focus will shift slightly from himself, but he doesn't return back to Karma Yoga. After talking about the ultimate level of dharma, that Madbhava Magata, then Krishna will talk about other levels of dharma. So the next verse will talk about the principle of reciprocity. So if everybody can become purified and come back to me, then why doesn't everybody come back to me? That's why doesn't everybody come back to you? Arjuna asks Krishna. And what about those who cannot become free from raga bhaya krodha?
is whatever their conceptions are, accordingly I reciprocate with them. And accordingly they will come back to me. So we'll discuss that tomorrow. Any question? Any one question quickly? Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Shri Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki jai. Gaur Premananda.